I took tomato juice, aspirin, and bromo-seltzer. I don't think I was addicted to them either. I took more of them than I did the sedatives. I had one of them every morning. I was a secret drinker. I remember the bootlegger would bring it in, and he'd slip it in under the back porch, under the step, you know, anytime I wanted it. The only problem was that was a cash and carry business, you know, so I had to keep going on this medical deal to keep paying for my booze. I hid it all around the house, everywhere, cracks and corners and the door jams. When they restored my house years and years and years later, I don't know how many families, several families had lived in there over decades. They were still finding bottles when they restored my house down around in here. And two or three of them they got on display there still. I'd bring it home in these little medicine bottles that I'd have around the office, you know, and I'd slip them in down my pant leg. Back in those days, I wore garters with my Argyle socks with the purple stripes on them. And those wild ties that I like to wear all the time. And I got away with that pretty good, but we went to see this Tugboat Annie, and in Tugboat Annie, they used that trick where it went down and those garters would hold your stockings up, and you could put two or three little bottles in there, you know. After that, I remember Annie always checked my pant legs when I come home, so the pant leg and stocking racket was out. I never hid it in the toilet. I figured, you know, Annie probably find it there. And years later, after I quit drinking, she said, yep, that's one of the places I looked. She was on me all the time, checking. And I had to protect my supply. I got so much better at hiding that she got it finally. Kept it everywhere, always had to have it. I remember when I came home during the wintertime, I had these driving gloves, fur-lined mittens and stuff, and I'd get these bottles and I'd pour it into those little bottles and I'd put it on those mittens, and when I come in the back door there, I'd throw it up on there was a porch over the back door, and I'd throw it up on top of that porch, see? And then when I went inside, I'd go upstairs to the bathroom, it entered out onto that porch, and I hid it in a clothes chute, kept it everywhere she knew I was drinking, and she could never find it. Because it was so important to me. I started binge drinking about this time really bad. I belonged to the Akron City Club downtown. We'd go down there and play bridge. And if I just decided I was going to get drunk, I didn't want to drive, and I didn't want to see anybody, and I'd just sleep there. Sometimes I'd go down the street there. Downtown Akron is the Portage Hotel. It's right across the street from the Mayflower Hotel. It's not quite as expensive as the Mayflower, and I'd check in down there. Sometimes be gone for 2 or 3 days, you know. I didn't want anybody to know I had a problem. I didn't want to be seen in public when I was on a binge, and so I'd hide out. I'd go down that Portage Hotel down there, and I'd check in. I'd use an assumed, make up a name, too, you know, assumed name down there. After all, who in the world would ever believe that a guy's name was really Robert Smith, you know? I must have been drunk at the time. They'd come and get me. They'd run down there. I'd make them promise, though. I wouldn't go home until I made them promise that I wouldn't get scolded. And once I got the guarantee, I'd come home, and the three of them, I was a pretty good-sized guy. They remember the three of them would get behind me, and they'd push me upstairs into the bedroom, and I'd collapse. I wasn't a mean, violent kind of drunk. It wasn't in my nature. Besides, I was a doctor, and I didn't want any kind of reputation going around about me taking down my pants in the front yard or something like that. You got to be very careful about that. But I did get to them mentally. I kicked them around. I remember Smitty graduated. My son graduated from grade school, and he wanted me to come to that so bad, and I was drunk, and I didn't show up. He says, still to today, crushed him. Those were the kind of things I pulled. Well, the Depression comes along, and my son Smitty says, that's when poverty struck. I'm losing my practice. The Depression hit us. I was a specialist who demanded referrals and was a well-known drunk. Only had about $1,000 to left pay off in the house, and I couldn't come up with it. We were busted. The only way we kept that house was in 33. They had this New Deal thing, a mortgage moratorium, and the banks by law couldn't foreclose, and that's the only way we got to keep that house and stay there. By 33, by that time, I had so few patients that I had to return back to general practice and try and hope to pick up. And remember, back in those days, a general practitioner wasn't getting paid anything. He was getting paid in apples and chickens. It's a very tough time for us. course, it's also at this time that this Akron Blitz happened. Thanks to Harvey Firestone paying their way, these Oxford groupers just came to town, and there was, Oxford groups got started everywhere. They were preaching it out of every pulpit in town. They had groups getting started down at the Mayflower Hotel. They had groups in private homes all over town. Annie started going to it. She thought that was really great. She ran across, became a very, Henrietta Cyberling, I called her Henry, or Hen sometimes. They became best buddies. They went to this Thursday night meeting over there, this West Hill group. And part of that Akron group, Oxford stuff, was sharing, you know. It didn't take long for Henrietta Cyberling to hear Annie tell the stories about my drinking. They decided that they'd try and get me in the Oxford group. It might help my drinking. So I did. I joined them. I went to a couple of their meetings, and you know what? I liked what I saw in those people. They had a sense of presence about them. They felt good. They laughed a lot. It was honest. I liked what I saw. I wanted what they had. So I went and I started into the reading of those. I got into that stuff, the reading of anything on the life of Jesus, anything on how to pray. I pursued this spiritual angle with all of my energy, sensing somehow that that was my answer, you see. I went to those meetings, but I just couldn't confess my drinking to them. That was beyond my ability. I started a spiritual quest, but I couldn't stop drinking. Somehow that wasn't enough. I went through that beer experiment that we talked about here a little bit earlier. You know, beer came back after prohibition, and I thought, well, beer can't hurt you. I talked Ann into it. She believed it. God, I was good. She believed it. So we stocked the basement full of beer, and it wasn't 2 weeks before I was drinking a case of half at a time, you know. Consumption just went up. I knew I had a problem. I couldn't stop it. Matter of fact, it got so bad there during that beer experiment, I even started mixing alcohol, straight medicinal alcohol, in with the beer, because I was drinking a case and a half a day and still couldn't get a punch out of it. So, beer experiment. Anybody wants to try that beer experiment, come talk to me about it. I got some information on you. I'm busted. It's 1934. Financially, mentally, and spiritually, there is nothing left. It's at this time you're going to start hearing rumors that I was actually dismissed from Akron City Hospital. That is not true. There was a chief surgeon there at that time, and he was dismissed for drinking, but it wasn't me. They were, I have no problems with assuming that they were going, they're starting proceedings. It's under discussion, sure. But you got to remember, the medical practice protects its own. They don't want this getting out there. You got to also remember that I was well-liked. Nurses back in those days were scared stiff of doctors. Still in a lot of places, that's true, too. The doctor's a god. He gets whatever he wants and whenever he wants it. But I would do very simple things, like say, please. They'd drop instruments. I'd say, thank you, and they would cry. I just liked people. That's the way I operated. They were some later. They'll actually go so far as to say they worshipped me. I guarantee I wasn't worth it, but I was different than most of the doctors that they were acquainted with, that's for sure. I'd walk into a room, you know, and all the nurses would all stand up to attention like they did in those days, and I'd come in there and I'd say, sit down, woman! And they'd just smile and love it. I was a human being. There's one story I will tell you, I'll finally have to admit. I was taking a lumbar sample one day off a patient, spinal tap kind of thing. Very painful, very delicate. You don't want to fool around with this. I got the specimen out and I handed it to the nurse. She dropped it. So I went back in, did a second sample. The supervising nurse was reading the papers and the documents over this later, and she asked, why in the world are we doing two here? What happened? She heard that the nurse dropped that sample. And, of course, that's immediate grounds for dismissal, and forget about ever being a nurse for the rest of your life. The career is over. And I spoke right up and said, Dropped the sample. Had to go back in again. That supervisor said, "Who dropped the sample?" And before she could open her mouth, I said, "I did." And she knew I was lying, but she couldn't prove it. So I finally do admit to you. Yeah, I covered up for her. Why waste a whole career over a bad day? That's who I am. You gotta remember, I'm a damn good surgeon. I'm a specialist. And besides, I'm gonna sober up pretty soon anyway. So no, I didn't get fired. I didn't get dismissed from the Akron City Hospital. What actually happened was Ann and her buddy Henry got together. Henrietta Cyberling, she's a very interesting person. She married into the Cyberling family. Old Frank there, found he started Goodyear Tire. She married one of his sons. They didn't get along too well. They never ever did divorce that I know of, but they were separated. She lived out in a little, in the gatehouse. Big giant estate there. I mean, it's a massive acres and acres and acres. You know, by the time they get done mowing the yard, it's time to start again because the grass needs it on the other end. You can wander around in those rooms in there and get lost and you need a compass to get out. But they did have a little, yeah, there's the gatehouse there. She, Henry lived out there with her three children.
Only very little.
It's small.
Yeah, if you go inside, if you get inside, it's owned by a private family today. You get inside there, it's cramped. There's that roof, that old English Tudor roof, makes it look an awful lot bigger than what it is. She and my wife, Ann, got to be real close buddies, and they got it worked up. Henrietta decided I was going to sew it. Henrietta was a very determined woman. She decided something was going to get done, she made it happen. She got together... Well, she had a... Delphine Weber was a buddy of hers. They got to talking about what to do for me, and they got this guidance thing in the Oxford group. They received messages and got directions. They were supposed to help me. They were going to start a special group just for me. They went to a couple of Oxford groupers there in town. T. Henry, yeah, there she is. T. Henry and Clarice Williams. He was an inventor. Neat guy. He wasn't an alcoholic, but boy, he looked more like an alcoholic than any alcoholic I've ever seen. He got this big nose and everything, you know, look at those long, that face there and everything. They loved people. They just loved and wanted to help people. Henry knew if they were going to start a meeting somewhere, the Williamses might let them use their home because they were just nice folks. That's the way the Oxford group was, very similar to what AA is today. Gee, can we help? And they said, sure, let's start a special Oxford group meeting. There's their house there. Pretty nice house. They decided to, Henry decided, have a special meeting on Wednesday night. She got folks to come. She handpicked them. And she told them all, come prepared to share something very near and dear to you. We're really going to spill our guts tonight. Everybody's going to give something that really hurts. Maybe that'll encourage Dr. Bob to finally say, yes, I got a drinking problem. Then we can really work him over. We're going to oxidize him, see. Well, they did. And I did. They prayed for me and prayed over me. I got out on my knees and surrendered my life to God, right there. T. Henry would always bring visitors that come in through the house who knew what this was. They'd come in there and he'd show them around, whatever. And he used to love to go over and just point right down to the carpet. They'd say, I heard this is where Dr. Bob surrendered. He said, yes, sir, right there, and put his finger down. This is the spot. He was proud of that. So they kept on having meetings there, Oxford group meetings, on Wednesday nights. At T. Henry's. It became a regular Oxford group meeting. You see, it was focused on alcoholism from the very, very start. Matter of fact, we got so many alcoholics, they started showing up there. They caught on that this might be a place to go sober up, and we started calling ourselves the Alcoholic Squad of the Oxford Group. A special brand of the Oxford Group. We had about 60 to 70 in there one time. It got so big, those poor folks, and we'd get out the chairs and bang them one against their woodwork, and we'd wet drunk and come in there and throw up, and we'd break dishes. Oh, it was a mess. Those people are so special. their contributions to AA would have to be in the category of co-founder, you know. They said, go out and join the church. I did. I went down to J.C. Wright. He just lived down the block from me. He had a Presbyterian church. I told you before that I wasn't going to darken the door of a church ever again unless it was for a very good reason. Well, this was a very good reason. I went back to church. I'm going to get kicked out of that church a little bit later on, too, because they didn't like this stuff about me being in the Oxford group and working with drunks. If we got time, I'll tell you about that. I have surrendered. They're praying over me and about me. And about a month later, Henrietta gets a call. Strange call out of the middle of nowhere. Maybe Bill will tell you how that all came about. Said he was a drunk from New York. Wanted to talk to an alcoholic. Thought he might be able to stay sober by talking to another drunk. Henrietta says, I know another drunk. We've been working on him. He just admitted it about a month ago. Manna from heaven, an answer to my prayer. One of those accidents of synchronicity. So she had Bill come on over to her place, and she called up my Annie, and Annie said, No, poor dear, Dr. Bob can't make it tonight. He just got back home with a potted plant. He put it on the table, and he's potted himself right now. He's passed out upstairs. You know, I hear a lot of that story about how he's passed out under the dining room table. That's not true. I went up to bed. I wasn't those kind of, you know, pass out just because you ran out of gas. I could always make it to bed. I paced myself pretty good. I can't quite remember where I was drinking that night, but, you know, it is kind of interesting. Where Bill was calling from there at that Mayflower Hotel that very night, they were having a ball, a charity ball, in the Mayflower Hotel that night for the St. Thomas Hospital. Once a year, they had an annual charity ball. Now, I know Sister Ignatia was at that ball right when Bill Wilson was there making the call. Yeah, somebody show me some pictures of that ball that year. I can't really remember if I was there or not. But they had decorations out all over the place, these little potted plants everywhere. Now, I might have been in a blackout, but you know it's possible that potted plant they talk about all the time, there was one I stole out of the charity ball that night, the very night Bill was making that call, we might have passed in the lobby, who knows. So anyway, Henrietta, she's a pretty persistent lady, she said, okay, if he can't come tonight, have him come on over tomorrow. And talked me into going over tomorrow. It was Mother's Day. It was on Sunday. I said, all right, just I'm polite, you know. 5 o'clock will be all right with me. We'll go over and meet this mug, but make it snappy. And Bill showed up a little bit. They went to church. Bill and Henrietta went to church that morning. They thought everything was going to be just fine. Sounds good. Bob's finally going to make it over. We're going to get a drink for you to talk to, you know. Of course, they didn't exactly know everything that I knew. There was a couple of ringers in there. I was very hungover, and I mean hurting bad. It was the worst fun I've ever had. And they didn't know that I was only going to give him 15 minutes anyway, so what the hell. So Smitty drives us over to the gatehouse there. Sue was out having a date with Ray Windows that night. She was, oh, good, the folks are gone. And Smitty took us over in the car. He's the only person still living, as a matter of fact, of all the people who were there when I met Bill for the first time. They're all gone. He's the only still living person that is alive who was present when I met Bill Wilson. Bill had already been there for a little while. He took a cab over from the Mayflower Hotel. He was there when I arrived. And you know, that cab driver tells an interesting story. He says he remembers that Bill made some really strange remarks about drinking and not drinking and all kinds of God stuff and everything. It really stuck with him. Where he tells that story is in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He joined AA, and he was the guy that brought... This synchronicity stuff is really unusual. I love it. So I arrived over there. Henrietta met me at the door, brought me on in and said, here's a man from New York. I think he's going to be able to help you. And I remember, I'll never ever forget, for the day I die, I liked Bill Wilson from the very beginning. You know why? Because he stuck out his hand and he said, "Hi, looks like you need a drink." He knew me from experience. But I don't want to go too much further. I want you to know a little something about the other half of this team. How are we doing on that tape?
We got about 15 minutes.
Oh, good. Now I'm going to let the person who slip out of this for a little bit here and let the person who knows more about Bill Wilson than anybody ever.
Well, thank you, George. That was pretty good, and that reminded me of my community theater days when we did Our Town, and we had the stage manager talking about Grover Corners, New Hampshire. Anybody ever remember that? That was a pretty good presentation. And I can't do that well, but yeah, let's give him a little applause here. I can't do that well with Bill Wilson, but there are a lot of things that are very interesting that come together here. And Bill's life, as you said, I really have studied Bill's life for 45 years, maybe even a little more than that, because my sobriety date is April 15th, 1950, but for a year and a half before that, I was in AA floating in and out, and even then, I was interested in Bill Wilson. So I never had the chance to spend as much time firsthand with Bill as I wanted to. Now, I did a tape a couple of years ago. Some copies of it are available here, called My Search for Bill Wilson, and as I studied what I knew about Bill, I decided there were 7 Bill Wilsons, that he had certain qualities that made him, that just fitted him for the job he did in AA. Now, George mentioned that Ebby was maybe envious of Bill or resentful that Bill became the founder of AA, but poor Ebby, even though he was a nice guy, he didn't have the qualities that Bill Wilson had that enabled him to be in this magnificent role. It just took a very unusual person with a rare combination of gifts. And I'm sure that the people who knew Bill thought that he was a gifted man in certain ways, but then in other ways he wasn't. And of course, Bill, starting out in life, never started out to be the founder of AA. He had other ideas about what he wanted to accomplish. But when I was early in AA and living in Pontiac, Michigan, there was a man there, the man who incidentally introduced me to the Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox, and he told me that he had been to New York for some meeting, some big meeting, and he asked me if I knew who Norman Vincent Peale was. And that was just before Norman Vincent Peale really hit it big with the power of positive thinking. He already had a national reputation, but most people didn't know who he was in 1950, early 1951. And he said he had heard Peale say that Bill would be considered one of the great men of the 20th century. And that kind of stuck in my mind. Apparently, Peale had said this at some big AA meeting. He was one of the early friends of AA. And years later, I met Peale and even spent a few days at a conference in Pawling, New York. And by this time, he was well along in life, but still energetic. And I mentioned that to him, and I asked him if he had said that. And he said, "Yes, I still believe that." And sure enough, some years later, Life magazine came out with the 100 most important Americans, and Bill Wilson was there. And so it's just, and Peale, of course, thought a lot of him, and as did a lot of other people. Well, I'll assume the role of Bill now. We only have a few minutes, and I'll just get started, and then we'll have our break and pick it up again this evening. But to imagine that I'm Bill, you'll have to imagine a guy that's about 6'3", has a little more hair than I have, but maybe about the same color later in life. Give him another 15 or 25 points on IQ than I have, maybe something like that. because he was a very intelligent man, and maybe another 30 or 40, let's give him that much. And he's got a kind of a twang when he talks. It's you hear him on a tape, and he kind of chews some of his words, and I guess that's the New England accent. But I was born, and I have this written down here, on November 26, 1895, in East Dorset, Vermont. And that's a little village of about 300 persons. And today, it must be a little village of maybe 310 persons. It hasn't really changed as far as the populations. And it's right there in the Green Mountains. And it's one of the most beautiful places in the United States. And looking down on some of the things that have happened since then, there's a big mountain there that I used to see when I looked out from my window, and it was called Mount Aeolus. Aeolus, A-E-O-L-U-S. And that has a lot of symbolism in Greek mythology. Now, the state of Vermont tried to rename it Green Peak, but the people around East Dorset still call it Mount Aeolus. They don't like to be pushed around by the state that much. They know what their mountain is supposed to be named, and by God, they're going to keep that name regardless of what the state of Vermont wants to do. And then my mother was Emily Griffith, and my father was Gilman Barrows Wilson. And they were both gifted people, but my father was a quarryman. He managed quarries, marble quarries. This is in the center of the Vermont marble quarrying area. And he quarried some of the marble for Grant's tomb and the library on Fifth Avenue, the one with the lions in the front. He quarried some of that marble. This was a big industry in Vermont, still is in some areas, although around the last quarry, I believe, in around East Dorset was closed around 1916 or something like that. But you can still go out and find these quarries. You'll see them with... did you change it? Change
no.
It? Oh, excuse me. You'll see these quarries with blocks of marble there, but they're like old gravel pits, full of water, and just sitting there in these dirty blocks of jagged marble there. And was a big industry in years gone by. And I can remember my dad getting in his buggy, horse-drawn buggy, on a cold morning and going off to work in the quarry. And, of course, he was the manager and had a good reputation for his work. But he also had a little other reputation. He drank quite a bit. He could sing very well when he had a few pills. And we didn't get that bit of information, but this has been rumored around for years. Now, my mother was a very intelligent, attractive woman. Her name was Emily Griffith, and her father was Fayette Griffith. And he was a Civil War veteran, and he'd been at the Battle of Gettysburg, an ambulance driver, which, of course, in those days, an ambulance driver was a guy who knew how to handle horses. And a team of horses, and he was good at it. He was probably one of the best horsemen, whatever you would call it, around. And he had, with a bunch of Vermonters from that area, he had served in the Battle of Gettysburg and was very proud of that. And I remember growing up, too, with the Civil War. It hung over everything. There was a man down the street who had been avoided military action in the Civil War, and everybody held him in a great deal of contempt. He had been called a slacker, and they used that term also in World War I. It never reappeared in World War II, but it was a term for a guy who refused his military service, and we were proud of that in Vermont. We considered ourselves warriors and that kind of thing, men who had come over the mountains with rifles and had settled there. And my grandfather was proud of his military service. In fact, on the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, he took me to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, for for that celebration. That was a great event in American history. Started school in this little town of East Dorset, and I had a sister, a younger sister named Dorothy, and she later became a nurse, and she married a doctor, an osteopath, Leonard Strong, who really became one of my allies and one of the last people who stood by me when the drinking really took over. When we were about 9, my mother took us aside one day and took us out to a little pond, and she told us that she and my father wouldn't be together anymore. And that was a terrible blow. It was something I don't think I ever recovered from. And I never saw my father again until I was 18. He moved out west and worked out there in quarries and various things like that. But I'd had a good relationship with him, so that was a great loss. Now, my mother was a more punitive person, and I can remember getting punished by the hairbrush, and she could really deliver the punishment pretty severely, and that was something I never forgot. Well, shortly after she and my father separated, she went to Boston to become an osteopath herself. To become an osteopath. And so she was gone, and my sister and I lived with my grandparents in East Dorset. My grandfather, he'd lost his son, Clarence, some years ago, so I became a kind of a surrogate son. And he took a lot of pride in me, and so no matter what my grandfather wanted me to do, expected me to do, I would move heaven and hell to do it. One time there was a boomerang. He came in and said that nobody had been able to make a boomerang or something like that. And I worked for months to make this boomerang. And I could see now that I was merely trying to get his approval. When I finally got a boomerang that worked, why, he gave his approval. It was just something that I was supposed to do. And I think now that this desperate desire to be number one and to achieve also became my Achilles heel later on. I went to school to the 8th grade in East Dorset, and then started at Burr and Burton in Manchester, which is 7 miles south of East Dorset. Now, Manchester is a little different town, quite a bit different from East Dorset. We always looked up to the summer people in Manchester. It's a town of about 3,000, and the people who came there for the summer lived in nice homes and played on the golf courses and were just there for the summer, and we were of a lower class than they, or at least we felt that way. In our house, if you wanted to go to the bathroom, maybe you did it off the back porch. And we didn't even have electricity in East Dorset until about 1917. So, you see, we lived a kind of a different life from the people in Manchester. So when I went off to Burr and Burton, why, that was moving into a different class. And I had to exceed. And I wasn't really a natural athlete or anything like that, but I eventually became the pitcher of the ball team, the baseball team. And that's where I met the Thatcher brothers, Canelm, and Ebby, and their older brother, Jack, and these were all people that were there for the summer, and of course, people that I looked up to. And it was probably a boost up just to be accepted by those people and to be admired for my baseball playing and things like that. I also knew about the Aquatic Country Club and the people there, and looked up to those people. And I did very well at Burr and Burton, and finally my sweetheart became the prettiest girl in school, Bertha Banford, and she was the daughter of the minister. I think we're at the end of the session here. Why don't we adjourn for now, and I'll pick up my story.
Let's take a vote. How many want to take a break and how many want to go on. How many want to go on? I see.
What about dinner?
Democracy in action. We're going to break.
Well, yeah, we have the reservations for lunch, or for dinner, rather. And let me regroup my forces here, and then I can finish the story when we come back tonight. You've got me with my girlfriend, the prettiest girl in school, Bertha Bamford, and I'll pick that up when we come back. Should we start the meeting again? Okay.
Rock and roll.
So I had this sweetheart I'd found in high school, and it seemed my life was perfect, and I had been able to prove to myself that I could do things if I put all my energies into it, and determination, drive. I could control anything I wanted in my life. I could make the boomerang. I could become a pitcher on the baseball team. I could become a popular man at this school, Burton, which was a partially public and partially private school. And also, I had learned to play the violin. There was an old violin in the attic of my grandfather's house that once belonged to his son, Clarence, my uncle. And I found this violin and pretty much taught myself how to play. And that was something that I did all my life. And Lois would play the piano and I would play the violin and everybody else would leave the room. At least that's what some of them said. But anyway, there was my life going along perfectly, I thought. And I had overcome, to a certain extent, the depression I'd felt when my father left, and when my mother went away to school. My sister and I had both felt somewhat abandoned, even though our grandparents took very good care of us. And incidentally, my grandfather, Fayette, was considered a very prosperous businessman in this little town of East Dorset. He'd come back from the Civil War, and he had started taking out hardwoods out of the mountains around there and selling them. He was also a landlord, and he owned the waterworks in the town and things like this. So he was considered a very well-to-do man, and he could do things for us. I had things like a baseball mitt and a rifle and things that the other boys didn't have in East Dorset. So I could never say anything about George is holding up a book there called Rural Free Delivery, and it's written by a man named Mark Whalen. He was older than I, and he was sort of like an older brother or an uncle maybe to me there in East Dorset. He taught me how to hunt and do things like that.
Mark Whalen.
And Mark was the mailman. He had a rural route and delivered mail in this part of in the rural section in this part of Vermont. And in 1943, he was even featured in a photo story in Life magazine, just showing him in his 1936 Ford delivering mail and being towed out of a snowdrift and things like that. So there's his book about his experience, Rural Free Delivery. George also held up a picture of my class at high school, and Bertha Bamford is in there, and I'm the fellow lying down in the foreground there.
Where's Bertha? Far in? Farthest?
Yeah. And Bill Flandale.
Who's Bertha?
Is my girlfriend.
Oh, is it?
Now, then I took a blow that still haunts me to this day. One morning we came into class at school and the principal came in and he announced that Bertha had died the night before. And she'd been operated on for a brain tumor. The operation was successful for this tumor. And I'm not sure it was a brain tumor. It was a tumor. The operation was successful, but she died from a hemorrhage. And that hit me like nothing had ever hit me before. And it made me feel powerless, like there were things I couldn't control in life. There was this thing, death, that was greater than I was. And I could do nothing about it. And I brooded for weeks over this. Now, most healthy-minded kids would have grieved over such a loss, but they would have recovered from their grief and gone on with their lives. But I became morbidly depressed about it. And I even would go out to where the body was being held. In Vermont, you didn't bury people in the winter. And I would stand there and have all kinds of morbid thoughts and think thoughts of death and so on. And it was very sick and very morbid, and it was one of the things that it kind of predicted some of the troubles I'd have later on in life. And I was so depressed and so out of it that I couldn't even complete my studies enough to graduate with my class. 1913, I didn't graduate with my class there at Burton. Even though today, if you go there, you will see my name on the records as a graduate of the 1913 class. And of course, my grandparents were very much concerned about this. My mother in Boston, they didn't know what to do about it. And my grandfather decided it would be a good thing to take me to Gettysburg. And that was the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg in July of 1913. So I went with him. And that was to show how the country had come together in the 50 years following the Civil War. And so they invited veterans from both sides, all kinds of veterans, whether they'd been at Gettysburg or not, just to come there. And it was put on by the state of Pennsylvania and the Army. And they put up huge tents. They called that the Great City, these tents, and they served all of us from the mess tent, somewhat like soldiers in the field. And it was really done very well. It went on for most of a week. My grandfather took me around and showed me where he had been on the battlefield, and where the Vermonters had held out against somebody else. I forget that. That was one of the things that was part of our military tradition. And it stayed with me when World War I started, that I had to serve in the forces and be part of it. And again, you know, I thought it was a great disgrace not to be in the service during a war, and it was letting down your ancestors and your country and all of that. Well, that fall, I enrolled at Norwich University in Vermont. And Norwich is a small military-type college. And actually, its graduates are very well thought of in the military. They're considered equal. Yes.
The reason he went to Norwich is because he couldn't get into MIT. I think disappointment for him. I think you mentioned that in your book.
Yes, it was a disappointment that I didn't go to MIT. But after all, they are very selective, and there are people who survive. And that was something I rationalized as time went on. But it's true that I couldn't make it in MIT. But Norwich was a bit compromised, and it would have been all right for me, except that depression hit again, and the first semester I just didn't do well at all. In fact, I had to go home. I went to Boston for a while with my mother, and then I went home to be with my grandparents, and there again it was that same depression and despair that I'd felt after Bertha's death. But then I went back to college and started to do well, and found that I had some talents that would get me along in college life. I was majoring in electrical engineering, and this proved to be useful later on in other ways. And I was at Norwich in 1915 when we were called up temporarily, when they had the expedition to Mexico, when Pershing went down there to chase Pancho Villa. You remember, General Pershing went down to Mexico. Pancho Villa had made a raid on Columbus, New Mexico. And then the U.S. Army went down there and chased him around. Never caught him. And a lot of people think today that that was just a rehearsal for our participation in World War I, which was already going on in 1915. And many of us knew that we would be part of it. Well, somewhere along this time, I met Lois. And Lois was part of the summer people. Lois Burnham. And her father, Clark Burnham, was a distinguished physician in Brooklyn. They were considered one of the leading Brooklyn families, and they spent their summers in Manchester. And the Burnhams were very distinguished. In fact, Clark, Lois's father, his cousin, was one of the leading architects of the time, Daniel Burnham, who designed many buildings in Chicago and elsewhere. In fact, he designed a building in New York where one of our central offices was at one time. But these were people who awed me. Now, Lois was older than I by several years. And somehow, I just found the answer. She took an interest in me, and she had a sort of a tea arbor where she sold tea by the lake near Manchester, and I found that I was dropping by there all the time. So a romance developed between me and Lois. About the same time, Lois was also being courted by a wealthy young fellow from Ontario. Go ahead, Peter.
What was the age difference between us?
I think it was 3 or 4 years. I've forgotten that. I tried to forget it, you know, being married to an older woman. But it's somewhere in there. I think Lois was born in 92 and Bill was born in 95, something like that. Let me return to the role of Bill Wilson. And I'm carrying on as George did with Dr. Bob, maybe not doing as well, but bear with me. And this young fellow, Norman Schneider, was from one of the wealthiest families in Ontario. They're a very wealthy meatpacking family from Kitchener, Ontario. And Norman wanted Lois to marry him. But she declined, and then that same day, we became engaged, the same day that she decided not to see Norman anymore. And you know, though Norman remained our friend for life, even in his 90s, I was in the big meeting up in the sky by that time, but even in his 90s, he corresponded with Lois and Bill, and there's a photo of me in my uniform and then Lois at about the time of our marriage. And you know, when they were writing my biography, they sent a fellow named Mel Barger and a young woman named Melanie Solberg, who was an Al-Anon, went up to see Lois. And one of the questions Melanie asked Lois was, had she ever had any thought when things started to go bad, and the drinking problem developed, and everything was going bad in their lives, did she ever wish that she had married Norman, who after all became a leading citizen of Ontario, and had the airport named after him, and everything else out there, you know? Did she ever wish she had married Norman, had taken another road there? And Lois said, never. It was always Bill Wilson. And I believe that's true. There was always a loyalty on Lois's part, an unwavering loyalty, which proved to be very important in view of everything that happened later on. Well, then I went into the military service, first going to Officers Candidate School in Plattsburgh, New York. And I discovered when we got to Plattsburgh that those of us who had been to military school, like Norwich Academy, had it all over the other trainees, the other candidates, who were just coming in from civilian life. We knew all the drills and everything else. And incidentally, at Norwich, I'd received quite a bit of recognition from the commandant for my ability to drill others and to issue commands and things like that. And I'd received outstanding performance on that, which was interesting. That was something, a gift that I apparently had, but didn't know it until I got to Norwich, and then later on in Officers' Candidate School.
It was a cavalry school, wasn't it? Norwich, more cavalry?
Well, they were general, but in those days, of course, the Army was oriented towards the cavalry. And so it probably they were in that direction a little bit. You're asking me things that I've forgotten. It's been so long. But the cavalry was very important in the Army in World War, still in World War I. There was still lots of horse-drawn equipment, you know. The mechanization hadn't come in that much. And when the troops went overseas, went to France, the ships carried horses as well as men. And so then I went from Plattsburgh. I was commissioned in Plattsburgh as a second lieutenant, and then we went to Fort Rodman near New Bedford, Massachusetts, and Lois and I, by this time, were married, and Lois says in her memoirs that I was very popular on the post with the other officers and the people, and sometimes I didn't feel that way because I always had that feeling of inadequacy, you know, and that I wasn't doing enough and so on, but Lois felt that I was one of the more popular officers on the post. Well, while we were at Fort Rodman and before Lois had come, we young officers were invited out to fancy homes, the leading people in New Bedford. And here again, this was like the thing I had experienced in Manchester, where I felt that I was from a lower class environment. And then these people, the summer people, were a little bit above me and so on. And that was the same way in New Bedford, even though our being officers and everything made us important people in their eyes during the war. But we were invited to their homes, and there was a family named Grinnell that was very important in manufacturing, and that was one family that I remember. And it was in their home where I took my first drinks. And my family, the Griffiths side of the family in particular, not the Wilson side, there was drinking on the Wilson side, but the Griffiths were very sternly opposed to alcohol. And incidentally, I should have mentioned that the Griffiths, my grandfather's side of the family, they were high achievers. My grandfather's cousin was the first millionaire in Vermont. He lived somewhat north of East Dorset. And then there were others who were lawyers and judges, very capable people and very good to their own family members. But they were rather cold and critical of people outside themselves. They were not that friendly. And later on, when Lois was interviewed by Mel Barger, she told him that he asked her if Fayette Griffith, my grandfather, was very well thought of in East Dorset. And Lois said he wasn't. He wasn't very well liked by the other. He was the leading businessman there. And she also said that my grandfather was a better businessman than I was, even though I'd been on Wall Street and dealt stocks and bonds and all of this kind of thing. And but Mel Barger figured that the reason that I was not as good a businessman is I couldn't have put somebody out on the street if they didn't pay their rent and things like that. But my grandfather could. Yeah, if you didn't pay your rent, why, out you went. He wanted to be paid, and I guess that's a good businessman. And he also had a lot of ego about any of his things that he could do, like his horsemen handling horses, handling the team. And one day, something happened, something went wrong while he was handling the team, and it went up on the sidewalk and almost turned the buggy over, and somebody laughed at him. And he claimed that he was doing that on purpose. He couldn't admit mistakes or anything like that. That's the way he was. My grandmother, by the way, didn't. My grandfather was a very strong-minded, strong-willed person, but my grandmother wasn't. And as Lois put it, she didn't take up much space in anybody's life. She was a gentle, kind person, but not much personality or anything like that. But where was I? I was in New Bedford now, and learning what alcohol would do. And that was the beginning of it. You can read about that in my personal story in the AA Big Book. Well, then we had the choice of picking our branch of service, and somehow I wound up in the Coast Artillery. And the other officers who wound up in the infantry made fun of us. They thought that we were playing it safe by being that the Coast Artillery is a safer branch of the service than the infantry, which it is, depending where you are. And so we were accused of having chosen that branch just because we were playing it safe. And when I was taunted about that, by other officers, it made me feel real bad. In fact, when we left on the train, some of them were calling out, playing it safe, and that sort of thing. And it made me feel kind of bad. So I was anxious to get over to Europe and be in some action over there. And I thought that I got out over there. On the one hand, I was very afraid of what could happen. And on the other hand, I wanted to prove myself that I could function under fire and live up to the traditions of my ancestors. But we got on the transport to go to Europe, and this was a crowded transport, as troop ships always are. And I was really surprised myself when we got into European waters, and we went on a submarine alert, and we had to take charge and control the men, keep panic from developing aboard the ship. And I was surprised at how calm and composed I was under those circumstances. It really got me. Then we got to England, and there was a quarantine. There was some kind of an epidemic, and there was a quarantine, and so while we were quarantined, I visited the old Winchester Cathedral. And that's a story that you'll read about also in my story. And that's where I saw that gravestone about Thatcher, the Hampshire Grenadier. Here lies a Hampshire Grenadier who met his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier's ne'er forgot whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Well, that's the way it was in the big book. It's a little different on the stone, but I'm still proud that I could remember that much for my story in the big book. And I wondered years later if this Thatcher, this Hampshire Grenadier, was maybe an ancestor in some way of Ebby Thatcher, even though his name was spelled differently, because the Thatchers, of course, came from England, and if you went back far enough, they were all related, I suppose.
That's a long shot.
But it was something that I speculated about. Well, then we went to France, and I did some more drinking there. And we never saw any real action in France, except that we had some near accidents in our training and things like this. But I'm very proud of the way I was able to lead my men. In that time, they gave me a commendation. The men under me, thank you. The person I hired to come in here and give me water. And, they gave me a commendation. So when I came back home in 1919, we stayed over there for quite a while. Got back home in 1919 and docked in New Jersey. And I thought that the future was going to be bright. I demonstrated this ability for leadership, and everything was going to unfold for me, and I was going to manage vast enterprises, do big things in the world. And that was my idea. Now, I've got a job to begin with. It was kind of a come down. Getting to be a civilian again and going down the street and not being saluted by other people in uniform. When I went down the subway, I wondered why the uniform guard there didn't salute me. I was no longer commissioned officer. But I got a job in the railroad and promptly got fired. And I did some other things, and I enrolled in law school. Things like this was, for a while, I was going to be a lawyer. I went to the Brooklyn Law College. But I eventually got a job as an investigator for a surety company, just investigating different companies. Now, one of the things about my whole life is that I never really held a steady job very very often. And Lois, again, told Mel Barger that I was somewhat like my father in that way. My father drifted from job to job, or was more of a free spirit about his work, and wasn't one to work for other people very long. And I guess I had that same trait. Somewhere along the line, I heard about Thomas Edison, and they were having some tests over in New Jersey at the Edison Laboratories for people who could work for Edison. Well, I had this electrical engineering background at Norwich, even though I didn't have a degree, and I had this interest. So I went over and took the tests, which Thomas Edison administered personally. Now, these weren't regular tests that you might get in a university or anything like that. These were tests that Edison had made up himself. And it took me all afternoon to complete them. And there were different things like trying to figure out the weight of the moon and stuff. Edison kept coming over and checking on how I was doing. And I noticed while I was there that there was a young Japanese fellow working for Edison, and he came in with a piece of metal or something, said they couldn't machine it the way Edison wanted him to, and Edison really tore into him. And that kind of gave me the feeling, well, this guy was something of an autocrat, and probably it was why I eventually decided not to go to work for him. But sometime later, I got the word that I'd passed the test, and I got an offer of a job working in the Edison Laboratories over in New Jersey. But by this time, the idea of Wall Street was catching on. I'd been down to Wall Street working for this surety company, and the 1920s were on, and people were making big money down in Wall Street. There was some big money being made down there, and it really caught me up. It was this was going to be how I was going to make my fortune. And I got this idea. We saved up a little money, and I got this idea of going around to different companies, visiting them and studying them, and then making reports back to associates on Wall Street. And I got somebody to back me on this, to go along with it. And we bought an old motorcycle with a sidecar, and we got some Moody's books, the Moody's Reference Service, and we started out around the country. And we had to conserve our cash. Sometimes we lived in a tent. And that's a picture of us on the motorcycle. And this is in the 20s, in the mid-20s we're doing this. We did this for a year or more. And, of course, part of our motivation here is Lois and I both liked camping. We had hiked up in the Green Mountains and done things like this. So it was not hard for us to do something like this. And a lot of times Lois would drive the motorcycle and I would sit in the sidecar, and I had to have my legs over the front of it. And we just traveled all around. And one time, we stopped up near Schenectady, and we needed to save our money, to conserve our money, so we got a job working on a farm for some people. Lois did the cooking, and I did some of the farm work. And right next, to talk about luck, right next to this farm were the GE laboratories. And I met some of the engineers there, and they took me into these laboratories, and I could see all the new products that were being developed, that were going to come on the market. I saw things that hadn't been on the market, but were going to become big things in a few years. And so this became part of my reports that helped some of my associates on Wall Street make some real money. And you know, we did a pretty good job, I guess, for those people on the farm. Because when we got done from our tour, and we got back home to Brooklyn, we received a letter from that couple that owned the farm, that was an older couple, and they wanted us to come back and work for them again. Which, of course, we weren't able to, but that was kind of a pleasant surprise, knowing that they liked us and wanted us to come back. And of course, Lois, by the way, was a very efficient worker, and a good cook, and could do all of these things. Well, then I worked on Wall Street for 2 or 3 years, and we had a nice apartment over in Brooklyn, and a very sumptuous apartment, in fact. And it just seems like we were on the road to great success. Now, my drinking was increasing, but it was no problem to me. It was a problem to other people. Some of my associates warned me about it. We went down to Cuba in 1927, and there were some incidents down there that disturbed the people I was working with and so on. But I didn't feel I had much of a problem. And I was, after all, if you're so smart, think I was wrong, why aren't you rich like I am? I'm getting rich. And as long as success was coming my way, nothing seemed to be wrong. But my drinking was becoming pretty serious. I'd go to Wall Street, make a lot of money that one day and spend it all, and then I'd have to slip under the subway stile to get home that night, or something like that. And I don't really know exactly how much money I made in those years, but it was substantial. I became interested in a company called Pennock and Ford, and this was a company, that a food products company, and I got enough of my associates into this Pennock and Ford stock that we almost controlled the company. And of course, I had some of the stock, but it was all on margin. We were margin traders. We had a very small equity in all of these stocks that we held. But after all, everything was going up, so what did we have to worry about? We were on our way to these big fortunes. Well, then in October of 1929, I was up in Canada, up in Montreal, and whooey, the market went. And in one day, this stock that I and my associates owned, the Pennock and Ford, it dropped 20 or 30 points in one day, and that was the end of all my equity. In fact, I was $60,000 in debt, which in those days was a lot of money. I was wiped out. Just in one day, it was all gone. Well, I telephoned a friend in Montreal, and he had some money left, and I got a new spot with him. And as I said in my story, I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. I was going to make a comeback. But it didn't work out that way. The drinking became worse, and finally my generous friend had to let me go. And this time, as I said in my story, we stayed broke. Well, that was 1929, 1930. From 1930 until 1934, there were many times when I hardly drew a sober breath. I never worked to any extent. I had two chances during that time to make a comeback. And in both cases, the drinking finally upset the apple cart. One time, I had formed a group. We were over in New Jersey, and stocks were at the low point. In 1932, there were just bargains everywhere on the market. If a person had any money and could get into the market, into some of these stocks, why, there was just no way that you couldn't make money on a long-term basis. Some of the really blue-chip companies were selling for peanuts. And so I'd gotten this group together, but one of the stipulations was that I couldn't take a drink. Well, we were over in this hotel, these people I was working with, and they were playing cards. I never liked to play cards. So I was kind of bored and wandering around, and they had this was in Prohibition, and they had some Jersey Lightning. And I'd never had a drink of Jersey Lightning. And somehow, I took a drink that night, and that was the end of my opportunity. It all fell apart. And then the next time, I was introduced to a speculator, a fellow named Joe Hirshhorn. And in Washington, there's a museum called the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden. And that was endowed by Joe Hirshhorn. He was a legendary trader on Wall Street, and he had sold out in August of 1929 for about $4 million, and he had his money all in a safe place when the crash occurred. And Hirshhorn himself, now Mel Barger interviewed him some years, later by telephone. And Hirshhorn has always said that he thought the market was going crazy, and that even bellboys and people like that were buying stocks, and that's why he finally got out of it. And, of course, it was a wise move. Everybody on Wall Street always thought for years that Joe Hirshhorn was a genius of the highest order simply because he got out of the market when he did. But, of course, that put Hirshhorn in the catbird seat. In the 1930s, he was able to use his cash to buy some great stocks. And I became his advisor, his analyst. And he had a high regard for the recommendations I made. And he made a lot of money on some of these recommendations. And he would throw a little bit of it my way. And then I would use that to pay off my bills and the delicatessens and things like that. One time I remember getting $2,000 or $3,000. And Lois was providing our she was our main source of support about this time. She was working in a department store for about $20 a week. And, but whenever I made a little windfall like that, why, I was cocky, I paid off my bills, and I was back on the road to success. But it never happened, and finally even Hirshhorn had to let me go. We went up to Montreal to work on something, or up to Toronto, rather. And finally Hirshhorn had to send me back home. And I didn't see him again until in the 1950s, after I was sober in AA. We renewed our friendship, and I saw him a number of times, but we were never business associates again. Another fellow, who was a geologist, stayed with Hirshhorn, and he was an alcoholic too, but apparently he could control his drinking enough to get his job done, and he became a millionaire working with Hirshhorn. Hirshhorn made it really big in uranium holdings and sold his holdings out to the Rothschilds some years later for $50 or $100 million. And that was back when $100 million was real money. Anyway, that was my life. And in those years, we tried desperately to do something about my drinking. I realized now that I had a tiger by the tail, and I wanted to stop, and that's when I made one of my first, about 1933, I went into Towns Hospital for the first time, and that's when I met Dr. Silkworth. And you've read about Dr. Silkworth in our AA literature. Now, Dr. Silkworth, like myself, was a man who had been wiped out by the Great Depression. He had had his money tied up in something that just collapsed completely, and he had to go to work for Towns Hospital, which was a treatment facility. Charlie Towns was quite an operator and incidentally knew a great deal about alcoholism and was probably one of the leaders at that time. And Dr. Silkworth had to go to work for him for about $45 a week, and but he found when he started working at Towns, he fell in love with the idea of working with alcoholics. He had never done this kind of work before, but he was a natural for it. He just had a great sympathy for alcoholics, a desire to help them, and he studied about a lot about them, and he became an expert in the field. This was one of those chance things, coincidences, that again was very helpful to AA. And I learned about alcoholism from him. He explained to me that I had some kind of an allergy or disease, and it was never going to be possible for me to take a drink. And my only hope was to stay completely sober, abstinent. And I thought that the knowledge I gained from him was going to be enough. And so when I left the hospital, I was confident that I was going to stay sober from that day on. And things seemed to go well for a while. I started going back down to Wall Street, even made a little money. And then one day I walked in a bar to use a telephone. And in no time at all, I was drinking. And so the next time I went back to Towns, it was a different idea. And I'll take that up shortly when we come back here. But This was a crucial period because this was the time when I learned more about alcoholism and more about what my problem really was, and realized that self-knowledge by itself was not the answer. You can know. Bill Wilson hat on again, and it's 1933, and I'm starting to fight this battle with the hospitals and learn more and more about what a terrible problem I have. Now, we made a lot of attempts to do something about this and to escape, you might say. Sometimes we went up to Strong's farm in the country, my brother-in-law, Leonard Strong, the doctor. He owned a country place, and also they lived in a suburb of New York. And he was a very helpful person to me, and about by this time, the only people who were really in my corner, besides Lois, were my mother and Leonard Strong and his wife. I just about lost all of my friends. No longer welcome anywhere on Wall Street or anything like that, and it seemed like all my chances were gone. At one time during this period, I studied Christian Science. I read Mary Baker Eddy's book that you showed yesterday. And I really, at the time, I felt that this would work. This would solve a person's problem if he really believed it. But I couldn't find myself believing it all the way. So it gave me some insight and some information that was helpful, and even proved helpful to AA later on, but it didn't get me sober. So 1934 came along, and we were living there at my father-in-law's home on Clinton Street in Brooklyn. Things had gotten pretty bad. The house had been taken over by the mortgage holder, and I had made my second trip to town's hospital, and an Armistice Day in 1934, I went on what proved to be my last drunk, and that's the one that you'll read about in the story. I started out the day to play golf, and I was on a bus with somebody, and I was telling the fellow that I was an alcoholic. I'd learned this much Dr. Silkworth, and then just a short time later I was drinking again, I guess to celebrate Armistice Day, which was November 11th, and I went on and continued drinking. I wound up on the doorstep the next morning, terrible shape, and I continued drinking for a number of days, and that's when I got the call from my old friend Ebby Thatcher. And of course I had heard some bad things about Ebby over the years. We had shared this airplane ride back in January of 1929, when both of us were flying high, when both of us had money, and we had disgraced ourselves in Manchester at that time. But this was one of the things I now remembered as kind of like a hilarious prank, something we could reminisce over when he came over to talk to me. And I even had enough gin that I thought he would be able to share it. Well, when he got to the door, he was sober and he looked much different. And that story, of course, is in the big book. He told how he had gotten in trouble up in Vermont, and two men had appeared in court and taken responsibility for him with the court, and presented this program. It was something of a religious nature. He said he had found God, and when he said that, I thought, well, he was drunk on alcohol, and now he's drunk on religion, but let him preach. I had enough to drink, and my drinking would outlast his preaching, something like that.
Okay.
And